So yeah, the Dutch Masters. This is sort of the second half of our lecture series. Everything up to this point has been quite sort of religiously orientated, and this is leading us into the kind of more modern, more secular era of painting. Interestingly, it does that via religion. So today we'll see how, despite the fact that kind of ostensibly religious imagery and icons disappear from paintings during the kind of 17th century, which is the period where the Dutch masters are around, there is a kind of religious impetus behind that that kind of moves us out through there. We're going to begin the lecture by looking, kind of closing off the Baroque period and looking at the end of what happens, I suppose, to that grand style of painting and that grand style of government and of kind of counter-reformation power. And then we'll look at how the situation in Holland was different, and some of the then looking at all the different painters, some of the masters themselves. So as we picked out with our opening image, you can see a sort of similar things going on with this image here, if slightly less so. There's nothing supernatural, there's nothing kind of overly dramatic when we look at Dutch masters painting. What we have instead is a slightly more low-key approach to painting, which focuses a lot on the individual kind of sitters. Here we've got a large group of people, all of whom have their own kind of... That guy looks like he's got a tattoo on his face because I've failed to wipe off the pen from the previous lecture. There we go, he looks a little bit less like a Celtic warrior now. But you can see in each of them, like this chap looks quite like he's probably quite friendly. This chap looks like he's a little bit pretentious, maybe. This guy looks like he's a bit up himself. You can sort of see from the face, this guy looks like a genial old fellow. The specifics of their personality, and it's that celebration of the individual's personality as well as their physiognomy, that is one of the really big breakthroughs of the Dutch sort of golden age of painting. But we'll also see things like the muted tones. There's a particular form of light that's very much associated with the Dutch golden age painting, which is largely the painting is drawing on the real sort of lighting conditions of Holland and Rotterdam, where this was largely centered, that kind of Northern European pale light and lots of muddy colors, earthy tones. Lots of people wearing black. That was part of the religious sort of worship, was they were all Protestant and wore a lot of black because it was part of being humble. Lots of group paintings and no paintings of kind of nobles and kings, and certainly not of religious kind of hierarchical figures. Instead, there tends to be of like guilds and sort of groups of people who've all sort of paid to have their painting and portrait done together. So yeah, we'll return to this one later on. But to round off where we were with the Baroque, so we return to the Sun King and the court of Louis XIV. So we'll remember that this is Versailles, Palace of Versailles, and here's the Sun King in the middle of all of these people surrounding him who are sort of celebrating him, and he's in the midst of all these rituals, and he is the living embodiment of religious and sort of political power in this earth, and everything is built around him. It's all very theatrical and staged, so that this chap who's coming up to speak to the king has to basically walk upstairs groveling, taking part in a ritual of sort of making himself humble in front of the king, who is the living embodiment of power in the world. As the years go by, this grand image that's sort of personified in the Sun King, it eventually kind of dissipates and it moves more insular. So these grand social spectacles die back a bit. The kind of huge public performance, which is so much part of the Counter-Reformation, which is that we should celebrate publicly the church and the power of the monarch and make a huge spectacle out of it. The courts move inwards and they become closed. So the son of Louis XIV, Louis XV, is here depicted in his court. And you can see that it's a much smaller affair. It's less grand. It's equally sort of ostentation of things that they wear and the kind of rituals they do. But that public spectacle has gone. It all moves inside towards smaller interiors. There's dramatic shifts, for example, in music, where we move from having giant choirs and huge sort of blasting organs to being very small harpsichords and sort of stringed instruments being played. And in art, it becomes a lot more focused on individual kind of members of the court and the people surrounding them. So one of the great kind of very late era Baroque painters, who's a sort of court painter, is Diego Velázquez, who begins his career sort of working his way up through various private commissions up until the point where he gets to paint the Pope. So this is Pope Innocent X here that we can see depicted in his chair. And we can see how Velázquez, as well as just having all those kind of amazing skills that come from the post-Caravaggio Baroque, so you can see he's got this, you can feel the silk almost with the lighting quality of him, the texture that's in it, and we can sense what the texture of all this clothing is like. And there's a sort of large-scale, grand, imposing composition so that this Pope feels like he fills the whole canvas and he's there. It's very Pope-like, you know, and it's based upon an earlier Renaissance portrait of the Pope as well. So he'd taken a pre-existing painting and put the new Pope into it. But whereas previous popes were largely depicted with the primacy of their social role up front, here he's put loads of detail into the individual face and character of this man. The Pope is a human person. He's kind of got this sort of slightly on edge look. He looks like he's looking at the painter a little bit suspicious as to quite what it is that he's going to paint. Or this might even be the sort of look that if you walked into the Pope and said, "Pope, I need to ask you something," he'd give you that slight side eye kind of look. You've also got a lot of attention paid to his individual physiognomy, so he just looks like a real person as opposed to a kind of idealized magisterial Pope. And so right here at the center of the Counter-Reformation, the Pope now being seen as God's, you know, representative on earth, he's higher than the kings, we have an individual, a human person, being presented right in the center of here. So as on the back of these kind of successful portraits, Velázquez moved to Spain and worked for the Spanish royal family. The Spanish royal family at this time are at the absolute height of their powers. So it's right at the height of the Spanish Empire. They have all the gold that they took from the New World. And the Habsburgs, who are the particular royal family there, we'll see in a second, but they had a lot of interesting tactics that they used to basically take over all the other royal houses of Europe. So here's Velázquez. We can see him painting with Las Meninas. This is from 1656. We see him painting the daughters of the Infanta, who's part of the sort of Habsburg royal family. And you can see how it's all moved a lot more insular. So we have the little girl and her kind of attendants. In the background, we have her father, and we have kind of various footmen and the dog and the painter, who's part of this very small court, a closed court of lots of people living very intimately on top of each other. But it keeps some of that aspect of the kind of, if you think about the Palace of Versailles, that hall of mirrors where they're all looking at themselves and looking at each other, only now instead of mirrors, it's paintings. So we have large paintings that are all blacked out. There's a painting which we can see that's the king in it. He's got a very distinctive face, so we can kind of spot it even though we can't see the face properly. And you know, he's painting, Velázquez is painting a huge portrait here. So they're surrounded by portraits of themselves, they're surrounded by art that's of them. But they're feeling very small and very closed in. Amongst all of these different portraits of, you know, royals and people like that, Velázquez also took to painting members of the court who would not traditionally have been depicted, which was quite a revolutionary thing and was part of what sort of brought him to international fame and why he remains a kind of great genius today. So this is Don Sebastián de Mora, who it was the court entertainer. Essentially, he was employed to do the same thing as a medieval jester. You know, he's employed because he is of short stature, and he would, you know, do cartwheels and performances and tell jokes, and was kind of supposed to act the fool so that everyone could laugh at him. But here, Velázquez has sat him down in a corner, has kind of made him look a bit more kind of stoical. He's got a face on him which is very sort of serious and self-contained, and his whole pose is that of, you know, it's there's nothing kind of foolish about him. He gives him a lot of dignity and a lot of character, and it conveys his actual kind of face and physiognomy and features such that we can almost read his character. We can sort of see into him as a person, and it very much humanizes him and gives him an individual kind of life. Another portrait that he did is one of Juan de Pareja, or Pareja, which is another sort of stark and portrait because it is done in exactly the same style that he does a lot of the nobles and the friends of the Habsburgs in. However, de Pareja was an artist who worked for the Ottomans, and the Spanish and the Ottomans had a lot of naval conflict. And one thing that occurred all the time in that naval conflict was the taking of slaves. So the Ottomans would go to Spain and across the coasts of Italy, and they would raid and take slaves back to North Africa and to Turkey, which is sort of where the Ottoman Empire was in modern terms. And then vice versa, the Spanish would go over and they would take people and bring them back. And so de Pareja was on a ship that got captured by the Spanish, and he was enslaved. And he ended up working alongside Velázquez because he was an engineer but also an artist. And so he painted alongside Velázquez. And so Velázquez did a portrait of him as just a court painter, as a noble. And so it's one of the very few portraits we have in that Baroque style of a black person, because they just don't tend to be depicted in that way. And it was because of this humanizing quality of that closed court. However, as we can see from a series of royal portraits done by the Habsburgs, there was kind of, as always in that kind of Spenglerian way, the downfall of every movement is based upon some kind of inherent problem right at the start. So at the core of the Counter-Reformation idea, the idea of the kind of autocratic absolutist monarch, is seeing that king as being entirely separate from the human race, really. That kings are like put on earth by God to be the living representative and performance, the kind of theatrical performance of power. Now with the Habsburgs, they took this very literally, and the Habsburgs had basically a policy of intermarrying. So they began with, this is Don Fernando of Austria, an early Habsburg, and Don Fernando was one of many different of these Habsburgs who married out. So he married into Austria, and they began as a Spanish family, but they would marry princesses to princes, foreign princes, and they would marry sort of princes to foreign princesses, and the children of those Habsburgs, who would be kind of half Habsburg, would then marry another Habsburg, and their family would, once you married a Habsburg, you pretty much would always then marry Habsburgs, your children would marry Habsburgs. And so through this kind of intermarriage, basically brothers marrying brothers, cousins marrying cousins, they ended up controlling Spain and all of Austria and Hungary, what's nowadays, well, used to be Yugoslavia, nowadays it's quite a lot of different countries over there. They controlled most of Germany, Luxembourg, Belgium, a lot of the Italian states. If you coloured in every Habsburg state in the map in the sort of 17th century, about two-thirds of Europe was owned by this one family. Problem is, if you constantly inbreed and are insular as that, you end up with genetic problems occurring. So Philippe the Fourth, this one is, began to demonstrate what was known as the Habsburg chin, which was the development of a very large-scale chin and a very thick sort of overdeveloped cranium. This, as we see in, here we go, Philip the Fourth here, which is his son, a bit older. We can see how the facial features are starting to show the sort of genetic wearing out of the Habsburg line as a result of intermarriage. And finally, Charles II, who was the most powerful man in Europe, reached the point where he was basically infertile, and he couldn't really, he would collapse regularly, couldn't stand. Even though he was the most powerful man in all of Europe, that no one would marry him because it was just so visibly clear what had occurred with all of this interbreeding. And so on a very kind of, I guess, stark biological level, we have the end point of this philosophy of royals being separate from normal people, which is that, well, if royals can only marry royals and royals within one family can only marry royals within the same family, you end up with this happening. So as this Habsburg Empire is sort of degenerating, becoming decadent, in the north of Europe we have the civil wars associated with the Reformation. So the Reformation has been in the background so far, but it's there in at the end of the Renaissance and then through the Baroque period. These are the kind of the heretical hordes of Northern Europe. The Protestant Revolution, wherein it began with turning away from the idea of art being used in religion. So they didn't like, you know, having statues and paintings and things. The amount of money that was spent in the Renaissance on religious art sort of disgusted people like Martin Luther and John Calvin in Switzerland. And they began by destroying the art in the churches. They then turned their eye on religious hierarchies in general. They didn't like the Pope. They killed a lot of kind of priests and bishops and monks who they saw as not being godly. And then it shifted even further and started being attack on any kind of hierarchy. So kings and princes and sort of any established knights and aristocracy became the enemies of this new Protestant sort of reformation. In places like Germany, it was very bloody and brutal. The 30 Years' War, like one in 10 Germans pretty much died in it. It was a horrible conflict. It worked particularly well in Northern European states that had kind of been left behind by the growth of the Catholic Church, the centralized hierarchies. And so here we have a painting from Holland, and there's some of the soldiers of the kind of Dutch Republican uprising, which was essentially a religious uprising that became a political uprising because they wanted to force out their own leaders, and then they were invaded by French forces and sort of German Catholic forces, and they fought those off. And it formed a new kind of mode of living, which was not sort of dominated by the old hierarchies, but neither was it a modern version of democracy. It wasn't kind of, it was instead led by this new sort of religious kind of, decentralized sort of state. There's no, well, we'll cover that shortly, but we can see in the very aesthetics of the thing. So if we look at these two churches, church on the left, these are modern, these, you know, you can go to churches like this today. Church on the left is a Catholic church, church on the right is a Reformed church. And so you can see the legacy of this Reformation even today in the churches. So in the Catholic church, we have this icons, we have statues, we have lots of beautiful art that's following in the tradition of the Renaissance and the Baroque, using art to demonstrate the glory of God. Meanwhile, the Protestant Reformation has stripped out all of that art. And you've got, even to the point of on the cross in full-on Protestant churches, you don't have, you know, the Jesus on the cross. You only have the cross. There's no human figures. There's no art. And then there's a lot of this pure light that comes in. So a big thing in the Reformation was destroying stained glass, because stained glass, if you remember from the Gothic lecture, has a kind of, it has an art function, but it also has a metaphorical function where you kind of have saints up there in the glass, and the light of God goes through the saints and onto us, and that's representing that God goes through the hierarchy of saints, and we pray to the saint, and the saint will get something to God via them. Whereas in Protestantism, you have a direct relationship with God, and so they want to smash all the stained glass out and have pure glass, because this pure light coming straight in from the sun is representative of the direct light of God going into the heart of the individual worshipper. And you are individually responsible for your relationship with God. And it's from that individual religious responsibility that develops this new sense of individual kind of your destiny for your life, your choice of your religion, your choice of what you do, and your kind of, you know, this one that we have today of kind of that the individual is sacrosanct and has a right to decide what they do with their own time and life. So the place, the Dutch sort of model of the Reformation, Holland was a small kind of country, largely, it's very, very flat. So half of what Holland is now was not there at this time. And the half that was there was largely kind of dominated by lots of sort of moors and bogs, and it was very watery. And it was largely to do with the coast and what went on with the coast, which is a lot of trading and a lot of fishing. So this is Peter Bruegel the Elder, the Hunters in the Snow. Bruegel the Elder is a great artist if you want to look at kind of crowd scenes. And so we can see it's a sort of view down from the top of the hill across all these little villages, all of them sort of little houses which are very dark inside, and it gives us that stark kind of dark and light quality that we see in Dutch art. The sky is very grey, there's very few blue skies in Dutch art because there weren't many in Holland. You see the sort of silvery sea, the sea is sort of light grey, sitting there like a mirror. And we've got the port in the distance. The port is incredibly important because the Dutch, towards the end of the 17th century, become the richest country in the world. They colonialism is essentially occurring at this point, and they're trading all the way around the world. So despite being very small and having quite very few people and only two big cities really, maybe three, and very, very spread out and sort of rural, very small, they have the biggest reach around the world. Their ships are going to America, they're going across the Middle East to trade. They go to Timbuktu, they've got most of the trade that's occurring in India and in Japan and in China at this time is all happening through the Dutch. And the Dutch are getting incredibly wealthy from this trade. And so the environment itself sort of supports small-scale societies. And yet it's that kind of, sense of these small groups of people coming together without a centralized government that establishes their way of life and also the aesthetics of the time. So here's a Rembrandt, the sampling officials. So one thing that you notice from the art of this time is that it's no longer about kings and sort of bishops and nobles. And this is because those people had been kicked out at that time. Instead, because there's no central authority, there emerged essentially by default religious freedom, freedom of trade, freedom of association. There was no one who would stop you and could legally tell you that you couldn't like associate with these people or have these beliefs. Instead, what grew up was a series of kind of informal guilds, people who were kind of came together for commercial purposes, or in this case with the sampling officials. These were essentially very trusted people. They were like judges for commerce, and they were like the people, like the government does today, where it'll stamp, like this wine is stamped as being good wine. And before then, the king would have his people who would go and take weights and measured and would stamp the wine. Even that kind of what seems to us a very official government-y type thing to do was done by private individuals in Holland. And all of these people were trusted to make sure that they would take, you know, a sample of any of the things that were on sale in the market and just make sure that it was accurate, and then they would give it their stamp of approval. People would then trust it and buy it. They were free to buy the ones that didn't have the stamp, and they were free to sell it without the stamp, but people trusted the stamp. And so you can see how this informal sort of emergence of things occurred. And each of them, as you can see, has their own little personality, despite the fact they're all dressed the same, because they're all Puritans, and so they wear that stuff out of choice. It's a religious thing. But you can see he's got slightly sort of amused look in the back. This guy's very serious at the front. And that sort of lighting quality, again, of the kind of very autumnal lighting quality. It's fitting that we're doing this in November. A lot of the townscapes, browns predominate. This is also to do with the humility of the perceived kind of religious humility of the pieces, to have a lot of browns, a lot of natural kind of tones. And you also notice in all of these cityscapes, they tend to be inhabited. So this is no longer the art of landowners who just want to see glorious views of their own untouched land, or occasionally, like we get in the Gothic, a couple of peasants scattered about for artistic effect. And nor is it the Gothic where we have groups, large groups of people, but they're there to represent the kind of the failings of the human race, the kind of darkness of the human body. And whenever you see large groups together, they tend to be moving in kind of writhing, overly organic ways. There's kind of sex and violence and torture and death whenever you see huge groups. Here, we have large groups of people, and they're all getting on fine. They all have their own kind of, there's a harmony to them. There's nothing kind of chaotic occurring. And there's just little patches all the way through of little human touches. So there's a chap here who sat down with his fishing rod or a rifle or whatever it is and speaking to an old woman. Two gentlemen having a chat on the roadside. Someone's agreeing something here. Down here there's a dog looking at his master who's putting his skates on. People are skating around, having a nice time. Guy's skating there with his dog or playing hockey or something. And there's just little scenes, like domestic scenes all the way through, but the landscape is inhabited, and it's inhabited by a kind of lots of individuals all having their own kind of separate experiences of the landscape. There's also, it's a landscape dominated by commerce. So we have a lot of windmills. It's quite windy there, but that's there being used for grinding to make bread, so there's food. And this big, what looks like a giant castle, is in fact a trading centre for the port. So central to it is not the kind of castles of old, but now it's looking at commerce, the birth of capitalism, trade, things like this. There's also a huge amount of maritime painting. the people who commissioned these things being the sorts of people who would buy a boat, the sorts of people who would commission a painting of a boat. So it tends to be with art at this period, or in any period really, looking at what's in the art will tell you something about the person who's buying it and the other things they own. So an interesting thing that emerges at this time, mentioning I guess the birth of capitalism, is that it's also the start of the joint stock company. So before this point, if you wanted to own a boat, you pretty much had to be an incredibly rich noble who could afford to buy it entirely themselves, or you would go to the king and ask the king to borrow money to buy the boat, and on the promise you'll pay the king back after you'd done some successful trades. In Holland, they developed this new type of thing, the joint stock company, which is the forerunner of the modern business, in which lots of private individuals could put money forward, and they would be issued with stock. And so, you know, if you suddenly, say a boat's £10,000, to supply a merchant, if you have 1,000 people all with £10, you can gather together, make a joint stock company, they'll all have a certificate. The trader will get the boat, they'll go and they'll do their trades, make a lot of money, because, you know, there's a lot of money to be made in trade. And when they come back, they'll work out the profit, and that profit will be shared among those people depending upon their stock. So it's the same, exact same thing as modern day stocks and bonds, but it's the first time it had been created, and this allowed a huge liberation of money. So everyone had their own little savings, but they could all make investments, and it suddenly meant that huge amounts of maritime, lots and lots of money was put into building boats, trading ships, doing trading, setting up companies, and all that money, well, obviously some people went bankrupt, but a lot of that money came back as profit, and it meant that normal people started making little bits of extra money, making business decisions, and this in turn meant that they had money to spend on nice things, which meant there was more jobs to be done for artisans, for specialists. People moved away from being 98% just, you know, trying to get food out of the ground, and instead they were doing things like making watches, doing, you know, science, making shoes, making specialist, you know, building materials, making clocks, stuff that's expensive, but people suddenly had money to buy it. And this new middle class, the kind of people who would be buying joint stock companies, are also the kind of people who would go to a painter and say, we've just bought a boat, can we have a painting of the boat, please? And so there's loads and loads of paintings of boats at this time, and it's because of this emergence of the joint stock company. And so you can see again the grey sky, the nice golden clouds, and all these figures by the ship that's being kind of inaugurated. There's a chap there with the drum, banging the drum as they all load up the ship. And this scene of tons and tons of sails, it's a kind of celebration of the new richness of the land. So the first of the Dutch masters that we'll look at is Rembrandt. Rembrandt, who's sort of the greatest genius of them all as well, like of all of them, he's the one to look out for, the most famous of the Dutch painters. And this is his most famous painting, which is the Night Watch from 1642. Like a lot of famous paintings, there's a sort of story behind it. And this one is that it was commissioned for the town watch at the town hall, and they had a certain wall they wanted to put it on. When it came, it was about a foot too wide, so they just cut the sides off it. So the composition's a bit skew-iff. You can see this guy leaning into the side of the painting. He's actually supposed to have a body. I don't know why they didn't just fold it back or find a new wall, but they sliced the sides off it. So the composition is actually not 100% what you wanted it to be. But the Night's Watch, it's done inside. That's one of the things about it. It's not actually a knight. They're called the Night's Watch because that's who they were. The Night's Watch was sort of, because there was no central government and state, there were no soldiers, there were no police. And so they had basically like men's clubs where you would sign up to be part of the town watch. And it was, if you were kind of, if you were seen as being respectable, they'd allow you in. And you would sign up for having a rota, and you'd walk around the town, so like two or three nights every month. And you'd all be part of the town watch. And when you weren't doing your night shift or doing your day job, you would go to the town hall and you would have a room set aside for the night's watch. And you'd go drinking and chatting and smoking and gambling and doing all that sort of good stuff that they do in private clubs. And so all of these, despite looking like very serious soldiers, are essentially just people with a bit of a hobby. You know, they like to spend their time giving something back kind of thing. And they're all playing at being soldiers. So they've bought their own guns and they've bought their own stuff and they're pretending to be soldiers and things, but really they're like a banker and a shoemaker, and, you know, someone who works with leather, someone who makes barrels for a living, maybe there's a merchant or something. And they're all acting out little scenes of drama. Like, you can tell that he's worked with them each individually to say, like, well, what do you want to be in the shop? What do you want to be? This chap at the front is the head of the town watch, so he becomes the kind of central leader. Down here, there's a young girl who's playing the spirit of Amsterdam, which is where they were, so she's kind of like his ghostly figure moving through them. And they all have their own little personalities and their own things that they're kind of showing off, and they're just kind of playing pretend as soldiers. Another one of these is the anatomy lesson of Dr. Nicolas Turp. This was a commission, well, 1632, a commission from the medical school. So all of these are sort of doctors who were high up in the medical school. They got together, they brought their funds together, and they paid Rembrandt to do them a big painting that they could put at the entrance to the medical school. You can imagine it being really good sales as well, because you walk in and you see this oil painting, and oil paintings you associate with nobility and with powerful people, and then suddenly you'd see the people in the painting walking around and you realise, oh, well, they're going to be my tutors if I go to the medical school. And so all of them are kind of aligned there, and you'll notice that not only do they all have their own individual faces and responses to this anatomy lesson that's going on, they're also pointed in an arrow, and so he's using composition to kind of point to this that's going on. The light is also falling down onto it. The light here is representative as well as being like a, you know, that chiaroscuro effect that we've spoken about before, using black and painting onto the black to build up the shapes. The light is also representative no longer here of, I guess, the good and evil that it was representative of in something like Caravaggio, where it represents kind of the light comes in and hits someone and they have a divine revelation. Here it's more in line with this new sort of secular notion that is known as the Enlightenment. It's this shift in philosophy wherein there was this sudden understanding and kind of general agreement that you could use your senses and the evidence of the senses and sort of testing and gathering of data and evidence in order to create an image of the world that works, that does not involve divine intervention. And so here they're learning to understand the human body, and they're doing it by taking apart the anatomy of a corpse, which had been done in the past but had always been illegal. Suddenly it was legal because of the lack of a central authority in Holland. In the back here, there's a chap looking at one of the new books of science with new diagrams of the human body. All this new science is being made possible by the freedom of thought that occurs in Holland at the time. The only weird thing about this is that his hand is on wrong. I don't quite know why. No one's ever been able to explain to me why that is, because the tendons are on the top of the hand, whereas here his hand is very clearly down like that. So I'm not quite sure why there's a medical inaccuracy in the painting that's done for the medical school. Maybe there was a secret reason, or maybe it was just a legitimate mistake. But this use of lighting and the celebration of it is sort of a running theme within Rembrandt and within all of this art. So another one of these pieces that demonstrates this is his Philosopher in Meditation from 1632. And we can see very starkly here that sort of use of the light and dark, and no longer is it a kind of religious scene, the religion at least has shifted into thinking about the enlightenment of thought and knowledge and clear thinking is falling on his head, while the darkness is like the mystery that surrounds him. And this philosopher is clearly in, like, he's not living in the most sort of, I guess, well-off establishment. He's underneath these stairs. It looks like he's in the basement. There's a chap down here working the furnace, working the bellows. And you'll notice that it's also very unclear. So later in his life, the older he got, Rembrandt increasingly used the sfumato effect, which you might remember from Da Vinci really enjoyed sfumato. It's like using kind of clouds and mist and the kind of what today would be seen as like also particles in the air, and that kind of to distort the image, and it elevates the quality of light and it softens the detail, and the human mind can kind of fill in detail where there's only suggestions of it. In fact, if we look at his self-portrait, the self-portraits he does all the way through his life, because they're for himself, they were kind of his way of allowing himself to explore art techniques even further, to take new license. So here we can see how he's really pushing this idea as he gets older. So here he's like in his 60s, I think, of how much you can balance between detail and a lack of detail. And so in his face, he's got a lot of detail around the lips because they're out in the light, and you can see the stubble and the, you know, the slightly jowly effects, and he's painted in all of the individual flecks that he's got of kind of a half-formed 3-day-old mustache. And he's given himself a little dot on the eye and a little dot on the nose, so you can see the glistening of the eye and the kind of realistic kind of glisten of a face that's slightly moist. But meanwhile, when we move down to the body, which is the central focus really as he emerges from the darkness, we can see that he's really, really loose with these brush strokes. He's kind of just slapping the paint on. And when you move further back, you can't really see that. You can't tell that he's rushed it, which is what they would say in the Baroque period. You know, oh, he's not taking the time to finish that off. He's just taking some liberties because people can understand it, and it actually ends up adding texture. So we haven't developed a full theory of the paint on the painted canvas yet. It takes about 150 years until we get to the Impressionists before they have a celebration of paint on the canvas for its own artistic purposes. But here with Rembrandt, we can see that he's starting to explore new ways of painting that don't necessarily always have to be hyper detailed and always have to be hyper clear. So in terms of understanding the kind of ideas that lie behind these, and the reason that this new kind of interest is being taken in the arts, in the sort of this transition that occurs during the Dutch Golden Age between a religious art and a non-religious art, I thought it'd be good to do a very, very quick digression to talk about this chap who's Baruch de Spinoza. So Spinoza is a philosopher rather than an artist, although he's been painted quite nicely here by an artist. There's lots of paintings of him because artists really liked him. But Spinoza was kind of one of the most important, if not the most important person in that sort of Dutch Golden Age. And he could only really exist there as well. And it's largely thanks to him that we have this transition away from a religious way of thinking, a superstitious way of thinking, into a sort of modern way of thinking. He's not quite there. But Spinoza was a classic product of the time. So his parents, and when he was a child, they lived in Spain. And under the Habsburgs, the Habsburgs, to consolidate that very central, powerful, you know, autocratic power, they brought back the Spanish Inquisition, and the Spanish Inquisition would hunt down Protestants and heretics and witches, but that particular version of the Spanish Inquisition was particularly focused on Jews. And so he was a Jewish family, and they left Spain because the Jews were being kind of persecuted heavily there. And where could they go to? Well, they could go to Holland, because Holland had essentially, it agreed to a freedom of religion, thinking that the freedom of religion would be between different types of Christians. But it turns out the Jews could move there as well, and they couldn't really argue against it. So a lot of Jews moved to Holland, including Spinoza's family. And as Spinoza grew up, he had this benefit of the new kind of middle class prosperity, such that he was surrounded by artisans. There was a lot of people who were skilled workers who no longer were kind of just peasants or fishermen, but were, you know, working on clocks. And he was always fascinated by mechanics and things. He trained as someone who makes spectacles, an optician essentially, an optician meeting kind of the guy who makes glasses. And he saw in the capacity to make glasses this kind of microcosm of philosophy and theology. So the technology that was emerging because of the freedom of thought, glasses had existed before, but this is the first time that glasses for the individual had been created. So you can go back to the medieval times and you can find magnifying kind of glasses to help you read. And the Romans used to, in fact, use what was essentially like a goldfish bowl that they would fill with water, and they would use that to kind of magnify if they needed to read. But the idea that every individual has their own specific sight requirements, and that you could, through kind of empirical measurement, you could work out what their sight requirements are, and using mathematics and engineering, you could work out how thick a lens needed to be to correct it, and using the new technologies and skills, you could make it, and you could pay for it using the new money. It suddenly, well, there was the creation of, and a massive demand for, individual spectacles and glasses. So Spinoza was one of these very early kind of people that worked on making glasses for people, and as he was building them and making them, even later in his life, when he was a world-renowned philosopher, he refused to take a job as a philosopher at the head of philosophy at the university and insisted on continuing to build glasses for people. And he was focused on sight, and he believed that this was essentially a way of removing the unseen from the world. If we focus on the world in a clear enough way, if we can see clear enough and use our own individual sights, because they're all different, we can contribute to bringing together a kind of new society. And so he spent a lot of time harassing, basically, just having arguments on the steps of various religious institutions. So every Saturday he would go to the synagogue and have debates, and they would end up as arguments with the Jews. And then he would go to the various churches on Sunday and have arguments with the religious divines. And through all this, he came to this new idea of, he essentially saw God and nature as the same thing. That God isn't something that lives high up in the sky in clouds and can be depicted with a big beard, that God, he sometimes called it God-nature, just this one kind of central unity. He also sometimes calls it the substance, which is a bit weird, but he ultimately saw that God was embedded in everything around us. And so, therefore, the old Christian notions of heaven and hell shouldn't be seen as being otherworldly things, but if we come together in a heavenly way on earth, it becomes heaven. If we experience the earth in a kind of negative way, if our internal mind is in hell, then we are practically, for all practical intents and purposes, in hell ourselves. And this new kind of bringing together of religion and science, ultimately, this that measuring and studying the world and experiencing the world being the same as religion, is hugely kind of inspirational for the artists and the thinkers of this time. He kind of, it's a big taboo, but he can only come up with it because he's in this place, and only in this place could people embrace it. And so it gives birth to this new way of really seeing the world, in which seeing is itself. And so suddenly the art of that they would already dislike because it was Catholic, but the art that shows, like, whenever there's a big change in the world, there will be, you know, God, when God gets involved, there's trumpets, there's heavenly choirs, there's giant monsters, there's multiple-headed demons. You don't need any of that. In order to depict the world, and even the religious world, all you need is everyday life. So Vermeer is one of the kind of best indications of this. Vermeer is fascinating because he really just focuses purely upon these, like, domestic scenes. And Vermeer is also relevant to Spinoza, not only because he was inspired by him philosophically, but he was inspired by him in his art practice. So Vermeer used what was known as the camera obscura, which is essentially a camera lens. But he would pose some people up, he would get them to pose, and then on the other side of the room he would make a black box, and he would put in it his lens that had been grinded by the lens grinders, and that would project that image into the dark room, and he would be in the dark room with the image projected on the wall, and he could paint over it, basically getting photoreal effects from what is essentially a camera. It's just the bit that in a photograph that would kind of turn into a photograph isn't there. Instead, it's Vermeer in there painting it instead. And so he gets this. Vermeer is pretty much the highest amount of photorealism that you can get in art. It doesn't really get much clearer and more realistic than Vermeer. But all of his scenes as well are selected because of the relationship of light and darkness to the domestic scene. So here we've got a high up bit, a light source that's kind of projecting down onto her. So that's kind of a Gothic thing, you know, light from the top coming down to the darkness of Earth. But rather than it being God's up there beaming down onto us, it's kind of the light of reason and of day that is enlightening her. And rather than it being a religious scene, like a big dramatic theatrical Baroque scene of someone like being nailed to a cross or having the head cut off, it's a mother who is serving some oats and some bread, just getting it ready for the family meal at the end of the day. It's a very small, domestic, everyday task. But because of this lighting and because of the very fact that it's being painted in oils, it's elevated to a kind of spiritual level where the humility is almost angelic. It becomes a scene that's elevated to something very special, a kind of moment in the day where the uniqueness of the individual and the fact that she's doing something that will mean a lot, at least for that meal, to her family, is kind of elevated to a special position. Now, whereas Vermeer is sort of a a celebration of the individual in their humble form. We have other painters that come after him, like Franz Hals, who is a celebration of the individual in a slightly more rugged and off-the-wall way. So Franz Hals is one of a series of painters that come towards the later on in the Dutch Golden Age, wherein no longer, well, there was so much money going around, and so, the painting became so popular to buy that it was no longer about royals and courts, but then it eventually stopped being about private commissions, and people used to be able to just paint what they wanted, and these became known as character paintings, and people would buy paintings of people they didn't know. And so Franz Hals basically had the great idea of for character painting drunk people. And so Franz Hals essentially specializes in drunk people, people having parties, people having fun. So one of his first, young man and woman at an inn, 1623, we have this young couple, neither of them are particularly, you know, they don't look famous, they look kind of, they don't look noble, they just look like everyday people in the pub that you might run into. She's got this bright red glow on her cheeks from drinking too much wine. He's got the kind of glassy eyes, there's the green coming in again. He's got kind of glassy eyes and a sort of slightly swollen eyes, like he's been drinking for hours. And he's holding up his glass in a kind of, he's looking very debonair. They're celebrating. He's kind of full of the spirit of life, but it's a very drunken kind of chaotic scene. But it's good natured as well. We have a pub dog down there that he's kind of scratching with, and we've got a chap looking on in the background with a big smile on his face, laughing at these two. Some of them are a little, like the gypsy girl, less outspoken, less obviously drunk, but he still has this kind of dazed look where he's depicting someone not looking at their best, not got even like brushed hair. The hair's a bit raggedy and all over the place. Might have been out last night and is out this night again. That slightly glazed look on the eyes that you get after two or three pints. And it's in that half light of the inn as well. The inn's kind of light is coming in. He does a series of great musicians, including the lute player of 1623. And here we've got the lute player, a suggestion even of that Vermeer-like, I guess, epiphanic, slightly religious moment. Even though he's playing away at his lute, and he's got that glistening look in his eyes that suggests that he's had a few as well, like most of Franz Hals' people. And he's probably in a pub, and everyone's kind of enjoying playing a bit of music, a bit of banter, a bit of singing. But he's looking off into the high upper left of the canvas, where, you know, that tends to be where God's rays come in. That tends to be where the religious epiphanies are. So he's having a little moment to himself, and he's smiling. And, you know, it's a very nostalgic kind of a moment of calm, I suppose, in this kind of chaos. And then here there's the smoker from 1625, which is even more clever, because all the pubs in Amsterdam at that time had square windows. And so instead of painting on a portrait-style canvas, he's cut the canvas so that it's in the shape of a pub window. And then he's painted this chap, who's looking a bit swish, having his cigarette with his girlfriend, who looks a little bit worse for wear again here. And they're all a bit drunk and a bit full of themselves, but they're having a good time. And we're looking in through the pub window, through that kind of smoky haze. You can see he's also taken a lot of liberties with his backgrounds by using the smoke and the light. And so Franz Hals became like a minor celebrity, well, a big celebrity in Amsterdam and Rotterdam, and people would come to buy his pictures of kind of drinking people. And he got some commissions, including The Laughing Cavalier, who you've probably seen before, from 1624. You can Google The Laughing Cavalier and find out what he's actually called. But this was a chap who, you know, made a bit of money. You can tell from his clothes he's a bit swish. He's probably gone and, you know, since being a young man, been off being a merchant, done some trading, made some money. And so he's got good old Franz Hals, the guy who paints those drunk people, and he's got him to paint him. And so he's painted him not in a kind of very serious, you know, I'm a nobleman kind of way, but he's put his hat on at a rakish angle. He's got this look where he's kind of, he's not laughing, even though it's called The Laughing Cavalier, but he looks like he's having a bit of a kind of edge to him, like he's like he might start laughing. He's in the middle of some banter or something. And this was so successful that it began a sort of minor industry where people would come in and say, I would like to have myself as the Laughing Cavalier. So here is Kleist Duist van Voorhout, who was painted in 1638, who basically came in and said, I want to be the Laughing Cavalier. Make me the Laughing Cavalier. You can see that he's perhaps been enjoying the ale a bit too long. He's got this bright red face of an alcoholic and a big beer belly, like a lot of the Dutch, but he's got his jaunty hat on, his jaunty hand on his hip. And it was, Franz Hals is a kind of celebration, not only of the everyman, but the everyman in his kind of everyman life, where it goes about drinking and having fun. Stuff that you just couldn't imagine Caravaggio necessarily painting, even though he did, I guess, paint inside pubs sometimes. And then the last of our Dutch masters is Pieter de Hooch. This is Card Players in a Sunlit Room. Now, de Hooch is fascinating because he sort of takes character painting to its logical extent, which is that by the time that de Hooch comes around, there's enough people just buying paintings that the artist has been liberated from all of the expectations of having to paint, having to paint subjects for money. The subject has now become entirely free. So, he no longer has to be commissioned by particular people to paint particular people, and instead he chooses to depict just scenes. So the scene is always tends to have a bit of an interior and a bit of an exterior, and it tends to focus on little groups of people who are like character types. So anyone could come into his shop and they could buy these paintings, and it would give them a little bit of a glimpse of a life that's like their own, but it's not any specific person. So here on the exterior, we can see that nice crisp spring light. You can see that up there, a little bit of blue in the sky, though it's largely kind of silver because it is Holland after all. And a woman bringing home what looks to be like a milk bottle or something. And so she's got her own little life going on where she's coming back. And in the corner here, we have a group of people playing cards. This woman's dealing them out. This chap's got it. Can't quite see it, but he's got a kind of very happy face looking up at this gentleman who's leaning over her. And we just have the whole of the interior kind of thing. It's fascinating to see the interiors of I guess, normal people's houses, which we've not been able to see before this historically, because we've only been seeing inside of rich people's houses. Another one of these, the courtyard of a house in Delft, is interesting because we have an exterior that's in scene that's got a bit of an interior, a bit of an exterior. There's also a mastery of creating the scene. His compositions are just fantastic. The amount of subtle colours between the kind of earthy reds and the browns and the kind of earthy tones on the ground and the grey. It just feels really realistic without necessarily being uninteresting. But here we have someone turned away into the street, clearly got her own thoughts going on. She might be looking out to see if she spots someone, or she might just be thinking or ruminating. Meanwhile, coming in from the side is a mother and a daughter. The mother's got something in her hands. She might have been shopping, or she might be going into the kitchen. Daughter's got a funny face on, like she's halfway through a story or has heard something she doesn't like. And you get this sense of individual lives, each of them filled with their own unique richness and of experience, but they're all overlapping each other and crossing each other. And so there is no specific center of focus. There is no kind of historically important story that has to be the center. Instead, everyone's own individual little lives are all important in the grand scheme of things. We all have our own things going on. One of his most famous is Woman with a Baby on a Lap, 1658, largely because it has a nice little homely domestic touch of slightly saccharine as well. But here we've got, again, another classic interior. We can see that very nice Dutch light in the background coming in. You can also see how plain a lot of these houses are. That's again to do with this Protestantism, like not wanting to fill your house with lots of art, being very humble and simple, wearing lots of black. But here we've got a mother with a baby on her knee, and she's pointing to the young daughter, a toddler, who's carrying a little sort of puppy there. And it's kind of like she wants to be just like her mum, and so he's carrying the puppy. And she's kind of pointing out to her, oh, look at this, look at the little puppy kind of thing. So it's a really nice little touching scene. Very small, very quiet, but really kind of filled with a nostalgia for life, I suppose, which would be hard to imagine in the grand, rollicking, sort of theatrical Baroque, even though it's using all of that good stuff pioneered by the Renaissance and the Baroque. So, yeah, Dutch Golden Age paintings, perhaps not the most interesting art period in terms of like what's being depicted. You'll be forgiven if you're walking around Manchester Art Gallery, for example, which has quite a lot of Dutch paintings, for walking straight past them and going looking at the pre-Raphaelites that are full of people like fighting lions and knights on horseback and stuff like that. But if you spend a bit of time with Dutch Golden Age painting, you'll start to appreciate the kind of quiet and subtle benefits of it. The fact that it's got this slightly washed out, slightly sort of dull and brown kind of looking light. It has its own quiet and humble appeal, and it's also essential historically for this transition between art being a grand scale, huge gesture, kind of important people and religious figures, supernatural entities, and turning it, taking it, and overcoming it, and turning it into this like small domestic thing that everyone can be involved with. It depicts normal people can paint it, and normal people can buy it, which is partly an artistic revolution and also representative of this shift in the way societies work that is first emergence of what becomes capitalism in the merchant kind of background of Holland. So we shall end it there.